And we started making diamonds and diamond things. And then every year it would double and triple and quadruple. And then, you know, we moved into Uptown office, and then we expanded to two buildings, and then we bought our own building downtown, and then we had 900 people working there and selling like $150 million a year. It was very exciting, and it was really interesting. And then about 3 years ago, it started to collapse. And it started to shrink again. And now it's just my work day today and this week. It's really interesting because here you have hundreds of people who have built their lives around this thing for 15 years. And it's just literally dissolving in front of their eyes, you know. And we're all standing around and looking at each other and saying, you know, what did we do for 15 years, you know? And we look at each other. I remember distinctly, I'm looking at Celeste Haynes, who introduced me to Anila. And her hair is all great. Like, we're all using all these dyes now and stuff. And not me, because I just fell out. But anyway. And we're all looking at each other and we're saying, what happened? You know, where did the time go? And it literally, we look at each other and we're just saying, you know, you got old, you know. And, you know, people are thinking, what am I going to do now? You know, like, I worked here all my time and I don't know what to do now. And people are scared and people are really upset. And people are like looking at each other like, what happened? Where did the time go? And then people are trying to evaluate what they got in 15 years. You know, what did they come out with? And some of the very smart people, they have saved up like $30,000 or something. You know, the bosses went from 50,000 to 100 million. And now he owes the bank all his money, you know, like he'll be under 50,000. And he's like shell shocked, you know, his eyes are glazed all the time now. And he's just walking around like, what's going on, you know, what happened, you know? And we're all just like, what happened, you know? It occurs to me that it's a little bit like dying, you know? I mean, it's a little bit like getting old. It is getting old. Everybody's sitting around and saying, God, you really got old. And they say, well, what'd you do with all those years, you know? And we're trying to figure out what we did with all those years, you know. There's somewhere in America, there's about 4 million women wearing these rings with our diamonds in them, you know. And that's about all, you know. And I only met one in my whole life on the subway one time. You're just wondering what happened, you know, what really happened? And it's just like 15 years just went like that, and we're all just standing there. It's like a dream. And that's the story of everything. That's the story. That's why you're here, okay? That's why we're here. It's a much different class than any other kind of class. I mean, supposedly that thing where you're standing around old and wondering what the hell happened to you, is why you're here. You know, you're here to find out why that is. And it's very interesting because this, you know, we could do a language class, and I used to, and I could do a textual study class, and we could do that too. But that's not the real point. The real point, you're here. We all share one thing in common, and that's that we're all getting old and dying. You know, like everybody in this room will be dead at a certain point. And you can go to a lot of Buddhism classes and you can study death meditation and you can study the bardo and what happens to you when you get old. And you can memorize all the colors that come and everything else. But still the bottom line is that you're here because you're going to die. And I'm here because I'm going to die. And you have to be in that state of mind to be in this class. You know what I mean? That's the point of the class. There's no other reason to be here. You know, John can talk about homework assignments and all that stuff. I mean, that's just sort of a trick to get you to think about it. But you have to keep the main motivation why you're here. You're here because you're going to die. And you're here because you're getting old and you can't stop it. You can't even slow it down. We were talking about a joke the other night, Friday night, you know, that there's this contradiction about going to the gym, that during the 3 hours you're in the gym to get younger, you actually got 3 hours older. And even though you might look better for a while after you come back from the gym, you actually got older. So, and during the time that you go to the health food store to buy vitamins, the more time you spend there, the closer you are to death. You know what I mean? It's kind of ironic. Like, you go there to try to get healthier, or you cook well to try to be healthy, or you exercise to try to lengthen your life. But while you're doing it, you're dying. And you're getting shorter. Your life is getting shorter while you're doing it. So you can't stop it. You can't slow down the process. You're dying. And all the things you've built up in your life, you know, whatever they are, they will just collapse. You know, everything you are, your job, your family relationships, your spouse, your children, everything you are, whatever money you have, anything that's going right in your life will collapse. You know, everything. And that's just a fact. So it's like we're just trying to do something. It's like a last minute desperate thing to do something about it. Because it's collapsing as we talk. At 9 o'clock, we'll all be 2 hours older than we were when we came in, and 2 hours closer to dying. And that's the whole point to be here. Buddhism says that that has a cause. You know, Buddhism says that dying has a cause, and getting old has a cause, and that there are certain forces that they make whatever you get run away from you. There's certain energies, there's certain powers behind everything you experience which bring you the things that you have, and then they will rip them away from you also. So the point of Buddhism, the point of this class is to study those forces. You know, what are the forces that brought you your family? What are the forces that brought you your job? What are the forces that brought you your own body and your own face and your own name and your own identity? Because those forces will change, and then you'll lose everything. Everything you have, down to your name, you'll lose. People won't remember your name 50 years from now. They won't remember anything about you. Nobody. What is it that brought you here, and what is it that takes it all away? And Buddhism says there are energies or forces that cause that to happen. And you have to study them. And you can change them. And that's the whole point of being here. You know, a certain number of people in this room will be able to pull it off before they die. And then the rest won't. And then some number will do it shortly after they die, maybe. But the point is, how many people in this room can study this instruction book about what to do and then pull it off, really pull it off, before you die, to change those forces? According to Buddhism, you can change those forces. And you don't have to die like that. Okay? And you don't have to go through a life like that. You don't have to be in a world like this where everything changes. I think sometimes Buddhist teachings get corrupted into what's the most pleasant way to deal with a life which is totally bad? Like, you know, what's the best way to suffer? How to be calm while your life is collapsing? You know, because it will collapse. You know, everything you have, you will lose. Everything good about your life will get old and die, like my company. And it wasn't. I mean, the company looked very strong and sturdy and, you know, 900 people and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of money and all this. We all looked so stable, you know. And it changes, you know. It goes away. And is there something you can do about it? So it's really a very deadly, serious class that we have. You know, I'll write Tibetan funny squiggle letters here. And you will try to memorize some things, and you will be doing homework. But the real point of being here is much more serious. It's can you, in this group, I'd say maybe 5 people will pull it off, you know, and the rest will be where? I mean, we can talk about it. We've talked about it a lot, but just very briefly, your body is made of one kind of stuff. When you hit it with your hand, it makes some noise, and it's solid. You know, it's made of some kind of meat and blood and bones and things like that. And that's obvious. And then there's your mind, which is totally different. And in America and in the West, we tend to think of the mind as the brain. And since the brain is made of some meat also, we think the mind must be made of meat. But it's not. I mean, the mind, if you think about it, is clear. It's invisible. You cannot touch it. You cannot cut it. You cannot divide it. You can't weigh it. I mean, when a person dies, their weight doesn't change. The mind goes away, but the weight doesn't change. You know, people try to measure it. You know, they put a guy on a scale and watch him die, and then 10:05, you know, his mind stopped, the brain wave stopped, you know, and did the weight change? And it doesn't change. I mean, there's no change. The mind is totally different stuff from the body. And according to Buddhism, the idea that the mind is part of the body is totally wrong. It's a big mistake that we have in the West, you know. And there are mistakes. Mistakes happen like that in cultures. You know, whole civilizations have a wrong idea about something. And don't think it's impossible, you know. 50 years ago, women couldn't vote because they weren't smart enough, or they weren't stable enough. They weren't allowed to own money, property. 100 years ago, in this country, you know, that's just that a whole civilization believed that was true, and the whole civilization was wrong. And the thing about the mind and the body is we're just mistaken. If you think carefully, and you really truly pretend that you came to this life with a fresh outlook on things, and you're not influenced by any of the things that you were told as a child, there's absolutely no evidence that the mind stops when the body dies. There's no evidence. Okay, the body stops, and the brain waves, which are a physical reflection of the mind's influence on the body, stop. But that doesn't mean the mind stops. There is no logical proof that the mind stops when the body stops. There isn't any single logical argument you can give that the mind stops when the body stops. You know, and the only argument you can give is that the body stops moving. So the mind must not be there. That's true. But did the mind die? You know, did the mind stop? There's no evidence for that. And it's just something that people told you when you were a kid, and you know, they hooked you had to hook a wire up to a brain of a rat, a head on their head, and measure something, and then when that stops, the mind stopped, or something like that. But there's no proof that the mind stops. And in fact, according to Buddhism, it doesn't stop. If the mind doesn't stop when you die, then the whole seriousness of this game has changed on another level. You know, then where does the mind go? You know, it's one thing to think in your heart that you won't exist here 25 years from now or 30 years from now. You know, it's one thing to believe in the back of your heart that when my body dies, I'll stop. And it's almost a comfort, you know, or something. But there's no evidence that it does. And in fact, according to logic, it doesn't. And then you're faced with the big question that Hamlet asks himself when he's about to kill himself, you know. It's like, to be or not to be. And then he says, he says something odd to dream. He gets into this dream thing where he says, what if the mind goes... He's basically saying, what if the mind goes on and he stops? He doesn't kill himself. Because it occurs to him that the mind might go to a worse place. And that's a huge possibility. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to believe that there are other realms beyond what you're experiencing now. I mean, you've been in really lousy realms. You know, you've been in other states of the United States, you know, and you've been in, you know, you've been in jobs that were really hell, you know, and you've been in emotional situations of your own that were unbearable, that were totally different from sitting in this room. You know, you've experienced altered states, you know, you've been in your life, you've been in mental, emotional situations that were totally different from what you are right now. And it's foolish to think that there are not other realms like that somewhere. You know, that there are not other beings and other minds in the universe that are in realms that we can't see, and that they are experiencing something there. You know, it's like very parochial to think that the whole world is Manhattan, or the whole world is what people in 1997 are thinking, or what CNN is saying. You know, it's very foolish. It's almost crazy to think that that's all there is, and that there's not other places where your mind could be right now. You know, it's very unlikely. You know, given trillions of stars, you know, given the whole planet, given billions of minds on this planet, that other states of consciousness are not possible. And I mean from a very frightening state of consciousness to a very enlightened state of consciousness. I mean, to believe that the range of the spectroscope, which you see now, is the only one, is foolish. Your mind is capable of visiting much different places, and you already know that in your life. And if your mind doesn't stop when you die, then the possibilities are almost endless, is what I'm trying to say. There are probably thousands upon thousands of other states, other realms, other ways of being that we can't see. And you're faced with those when you die. You know, your mind will go on. There's no evidence that your mind will stop. And you will go by yourself. Nobody will go with you. You know, at the moment of death, your mind takes off in its personal direction. And it's unique. And it's not like you're going to meet the rest of us again, likely. I mean, if there's trillions of beings, billions of beings that we know about, trillions and trillions that we have no idea of, the idea that you might be with us in the future is unlikely. And the idea that you might be in this kind of place in the future is extremely unlikely. I mean, there's billions of combinations that could occur. So to be alive and to be in this room and to have a mind that hasn't moved yet, that hasn't moved from this body yet, is extraordinarily rare. You know, to be in a state of consciousness where you can think straight and where you're semi-healthy, you know, and where you've got enough food, and to be in a class that's talking about these things is almost impossible. I mean, it's very unlikely to happen again. And the question is, are these books true? You know, but the book you're going to study says that you can take control of those forces and that you can change those forces, that you can understand them, you can study them, and then you can use them to determine where you're going to be and to change where you're going to be. I'm not interested in teaching a class about how to be calm or serene in the face of death and in the face of great suffering. I mean, life is like that. It's not the point. You know, this is not a, what do you call it, calmness class. You know, it's not that. Yeah, it's not stress reduction. I mean, you'll actually get much more stress, and then you'll have no stress at all. But the life that we're dealing with is extremely serious. There's no way out, apparently. And this book says there is. You know, of all the things you've ever done, and all the places you've ever been, all the books you've ever heard about, this one says you can change and control those things. You can not only stop the experience of losing things and of getting old and these forces which rip things away from you, you can actually stop them completely and convert it into some kind of extraordinary, enlightened paradise. You know, you can do that, and you can do it in the same way that you drive a car. You know, you just get the instructions and you do it and it works. You know, so this book says that you can learn the instructions for doing that, and if you do it in a sincere way, you just do it. You just pull it off. And if you don't, then if you fail in this class, and I don't mean you don't do your homework, right? If you fail in the sense that you either don't get it, you know, you don't get the subject, or worse, that you can't put it into practice, then the consequences are very, really, they're really, really terrible. They're like, you cannot keep a single physical thing about your life. Every good thing about your life will be destroyed, period. By definition, you know, any good thing you have now, within 10 years from now, will be torn away from you, 90%. Okay, you may still have your faith. You may still have your name. You may still have a few members of your family. Give it 20 years and it'll be even less. You know, and eventually you must lose everything. It must be ripped away from you. So that's on the physical side. I mean, the mental we didn't even talk about. I mean, the same forces that make you lose everything good about yourself and your life also control your thoughts. And we cannot, in our current condition, maintain a happy thought for more than a few minutes. Cannot do it. You know, the mind that we have now, due to the same forces, is not allowed to have a happy thought for very long. You cannot have a happy thought for very long. We have a kind of suffering. There's a kind of forces that control our minds, and you cannot be contented. Period. You know, your life is one long history of trying to find something that makes you happy. If you get it, which is unlikely, as you know, it changes, or you change. And within a day or two, you want something else. It's very weird. No matter what you get, no matter what you or I get, we cannot be satisfied. It's some kind of curse in the mind, and we have it. And it's the same thing that's making you old, and it's the same thing that's going to make you die. I mean, the same poison that causes those things is causing in the mind the inability to be happy. You cannot be happy. We cannot be happy. The current condition of the mind is that any time you get what you're looking for, within a short time, your mind changes and you want something else. And it's the nature of our minds. And it's driven by the same forces that make you get old and die. And that's the way we are. We cannot be happy. Not capable of it. You know, you could get everything you dream of and you couldn't be happy. It's weird. And if you've ever had it happen to you, you know. You know, I mean, most people don't get the chance, okay? But we can't be satisfied. It's a curse. And we all have it. You know, we all have it. If you are a normal person, if you're not some holy being in disguise, you have it. If you think about it for a few minutes, you have it. So your body is, in a sense, cursed by certain forces. Your whole life, your career, your family, everything about you, your house, the place you live, your own health, your own looks, everything is going to collapse. And on top of that, the mind is currently not able to be happy. You can't do it. You know, it doesn't matter if you changed your apartment, or your spouse, or your children, or if you suddenly got healthy and your bad back went away. I mean, there's no combination of external or inner circumstances which can make our minds happy right now. Can't. And so the same forces are driving that. So the point of this book is to study those forces. And that's my sales pitch. I have lots of doubts about my life, you know, should I do this, should I do that, you know, like everybody. And then I always just think, you know, I always think, did I do the right thing with my life, you know, and then I think, well, of course I have, because all these things are true, all the things I just said are true. So there's no question. That's the test, that's the litmus test. What you're doing is right. You know, if you study, I mean, there's two possibilities, either this book works or it doesn't work. The third possibility is to go out and do what you were doing before, which doesn't work. So it's like that. This book supposedly works. Let's check it out. You know, just try it. And then if it doesn't work, you know, maybe consider suicide or something. I don't know. You know? It's like that. I mean, the condition is like that. The condition is really like that. So let's try it, try it. I mean, I believe that a few people in this room will be able to pull it off. You know, I pray that many people, I really pray that many people. It's very difficult, but you can do it. You will learn all the instructions you need to pull it off. Then we have to help each other, support each other, try to induce each other to do it. You know, at least you're going to learn the instructions here. And that's what the point of this class is. I'll start the real class, and maybe that was the real class. I'm going to write Tibetan. It's a great blessing because this tradition was preserved by the Tibetans and brought to us by the Tibetans. If they had not worked so hard and passed it down so purely from generation to generation, down to our root lama, Khenrem Pichay Geshe Losan Tarjan, then it wouldn't be here. So it's important to study the Tibetan, look at the Tibetan. I ask you to repeat things in Tibetan, okay? Even if you're not interested in learning Tibetan. I'd say some percentage of the students here who are already teaching Tibetan were not interested in Tibetan when they got here. And then they found out it was easy and it was fun and that there's thousands of books written in Tibetan that aren't in English yet. And they learned it. And it's not very hard, actually. I mean, we like to pretend that we're very smart. But actually, it's kind of a simple language. Not at all like Russian or anything like that. Or English. Okay? Very simple. And very beautiful. And it's a big blessing if you can learn a little bit of it. Okay? If you're absolutely new and you want to take it in Tibetan, then I'm going to put the pronunciation there. And you can do your homework and quizzes in the pronunciation. And then you work with Thubten Phuntso and you try to learn the alphabet and stuff like that. You don't have to do it, okay? So don't get scared. Don't run away tonight. All right? If you're not in the mood to learn Tibetan, you don't have to, and no obligation. But please make the noises. And then we say there's some blessing put in your mind just from that holy language, okay? Say, Changchun. Make noise, okay? We got this big place. We didn't know how many people were going to show up. It's empty. Nobody can hear you outside. There's all this traffic and stuff. So make noise. It stays in your mind. We say in the debate ground that the louder you are, the more blessings it is because there are beings around us that you can't see. Some of them are just within earshot. So if you make noise, seriously, it helps them, okay? You might be one of them tomorrow. So make noise. Don't think it's impossible. You know, we had a tie-up grading the class papers from a course we had in California, and we sent them out like a couple weeks ago, about 3 months late. And I got a card back that said, "Dear Mr. Roach, you know, thank you very much. I'm sure Frank would have appreciated getting his grades, you know." And he died, you know. So it'll happen, you know. So, Changchu, Sembe, Chöpala, Jukpa. Changchu Semba means Bodhisattva. Okay, Bodhisattva. Changchu means Bodhi. By the way, the thing on the bottom is the Sanskrit. The thing on the top is the Tibetan. Changchu means Buddhahood. Semba is a beautiful word meaning a warrior. Okay, a soldier or a warrior. Like a warrior. Okay. Semba. Semba. Chöpa means how they behave, their way of life. Okay. Chöpa means their way of life. Jukpa means, La Jukpa means entering into, getting into. Somebody's translated it this way and I kind of like it. You know, literally it's entering the Bodhisattva's way of life. But we can call it Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Okay. And that's the book you're going to be studying. I told the story Friday, true story, meeting the Dalai Lama's tutor in a train station, having him ask me in Tibetan, "What book are you studying?" And my teacher standing behind him and going, and I didn't know the name of the book, and it was really stupid. So, very embarrassing. So, learn the name of the book you're studying, okay? For those of you who know Tibetan, the short name and the name by which this book is known among Tibetan scholars in the monasteries is Chunjuk. Say Chunjuk. Chunjuk. Okay, the N sound is from the prenasal, Ao. Okay, for those of you interested, Chunjuk. Okay, that's the short name. Somebody says, "What are you studying?" You say, "Chunjuk." Okay, even if you have no idea what it means. Okay, I'm studying Chunjuk. Okay. All right. Chunjuk. Say Shiwa.
Shiwa.
Ha. Shiva, Ha. In Sanskrit, Shanti Deva. Shanti means peace. Deva means, I like to call it angel, but I have to explain what angel means in Buddhism. It's not like Christianity, maybe, or maybe it is, I don't know. Anyway, if you are able to practice this path perfectly, then at some point before you die, your body will start to change. and your mind will start to change. And actually, they start to support each other. The change in the body supports the change in the mind, and vice versa. And you actually change. This physical form changes. You enter another kind of body. You might look exactly the same to other people. They may not be at all aware of the change in you, but you see perfectly a completely different kind of body and a completely different state of consciousness. It's totally enlightened, totally blissful, and the body is totally pure and will never go through any kind of aging or anything like that. What other people see is a different question, and we'll talk about that sometime. It has to do with emptiness. It has to do with the emptiness of the body. But that's what I'm calling an angel. Okay, when you become that, mind is totally pure, and your body is changed. Okay, and you've transformed into something else. That's the point. That's the goal. Okay, you can do it, and this is the instruction book for it. Okay, it really is contained in this book. You know, whether you can pull it off is up to you. But I think the inspiration of death is quite strong. You know, hopefully a few people close to you will die in the next few weeks and you'll get inspired. Okay? It's hard to do it unless that happens. Okay? Shivaha. So the author of the book we are reading is Shantideva. He lived about 700 AD. We don't know exactly. Some scholars have estimated 695 to 740 something or something like that. In Buddhism, we don't normally refer to a very holy being with their plain name. We don't say, Dali or something like that. You know, we say His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And so normally we have to add an honorific or some kind of word. Especially it becomes very serious in the secret teachings that you have to do this. So we're going to give him his proper title. And I hope I never hear a student in this class say, Shantideva. Okay. It's like saying, hey, Clinton. Okay. So, Mr. President. Gelse Shivatha. Okay. Gelse means Gyalwese. Gyalwese means child of the victorious Buddhas. Okay. Child of the Buddhas. Daughter or son of the Buddhas. And it means a bodhisattva. It's a word for a bodhisattva. Okay. So his real name is the Bodhisattva Shantideva. I'm going to write the name. We're going to study a commentary. Normally the early books of Buddhism are very hard to study unless you get an explanation from a later source. It's very hard normally to read something that was written 13 centuries ago. And so there have over the time been a great series of commentaries. And we're going to study what is, I believe, the best commentary ever written on this book. Say Gyaltsab Jay. Gyaltsab Jay. Gyaltsab Jay was a very famous student of the most famous Tibetan Buddhist master of all time. That's Jetsun Kapa. I'll spell that for you. Jetsun Kapa was the teacher of the first Dalai Lama. And he was the person who pretty much started Buddhism as you and I are learning it. Okay, great master from Tibet. Dates? Yeah. I always pretend like I know, you know. Jetsun Kapa was a student of the first Dalai Lama. I'm sorry, he was a teacher of the first Dalai Lama. And another one of his famous students was Gyaltsab Jay. Gyaltsab means, atsab in modern colloquial Tibetan means a substitute, any kind of substitute. Gyaltsab means a regent or someone who takes over the throne of the teacher who was before. So Gyaltsab Jay was the first holder of the throne of Jetsun Kapa after he passed away. And that's what his name means. Gyaltsab Jay means the throne holder, the holder of the throne of Jetsun Kapa. Okay. His monk's name was Dharma Rinchen. This Dharma is not the Dharma, okay? So don't get confused. It's just it's another Tibetan word, okay? It's not the word for Buddhist religion Dharma, okay? It's a different Dharma, okay? It doesn't mean Dharma. Okay, some people mistake that and they spell his name wrong. Okay, Dharma Rinchen was his monk's name. So the main text you're studying is the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Master Shantideva. And you're studying this commentary called Entry Point for Children of the Victorious Buddhist, Daughters or Sons of the Victorious Buddhist, which is a code word for Bodhisattva. Okay? Child of the Victorious Buddhist is a code word in Buddhism for Bodhisattva. So it's really the point of entry for Bodhisattvas. Point of entry, this word in Tibetan is used in Tibet. There were no highways, there were no bridges. When you came to a river, which was frequent in Tibet, if you were going from Lhasa, 50 miles from Lhasa, you had to cross maybe 20 different rivers, very cold rivers, and you pace up and down the bank and you try to find the Jungong. The Jungong is the most convenient place to cross without, you know, get the least wet that you can, you know. So you have to like walk up and down and find out a place where your horse can get into the water and get to the other side without you getting too wet in a snow, you know, in melted snow. So Jungok is very important in Tibet. Jungok means that particular point where it's the easiest place to get into it and get on the other side. So really this book's title has a very important meaning. It's like, what's the easiest place for normal people like you and me living in the 20th century to get into Bodhisattva behavior and get to the other side? Which is death, getting beyond death, and getting beyond suffering. Okay, and that's the meaning of this book's title. I wanted to give you just a little bit about Master Shantideva's life. All we know is he was born around 700 AD. He was born somewhere in the... By the way, you have in your reading, which you'll get, a whole description of his life. It's about all we know. It's about 3 pages long in Tibetan. The description that you get in your reading just came. We were just sitting around one day, the people who are translating the commentary, and we were wondering, you know, is there anything about Shantideva's life that we could find? And we found a biography by the teacher of the 8th Dalai Lama, whose name was Yongzhen Yeshe Gyantsen, and he was the personal tutor of the 8th Dalai Lama. And then he wrote a book of biographies of the great teachers of Buddhism, especially of the Lam Rim. And in there he gives a life story of Shantideva. So I thought you would like to hear a little bit about Master Shantideva's life. He was born in the area of Bodh Gaya, which is like northeast India, where the Buddha himself was enlightened. And he was born into a royal family. He was a prince. And we were talking about it Friday night. You have to really appreciate what a prince was in India. A king in India wasn't like Bill Clinton. He was much more. I mean, a king in India owned everything in the country. I mean, owned everything. It wasn't like he just had some good power over a certain section of things. I mean, if he came to your house and said, I like your horse, or I like your kids, or I like your wife, or I like your house, you gave it to him because he owned it. He owned everything. He owns everything in the kingdom. And this is the nature of a king in the old days. I mean, total control over every object in the kingdom. And that's what it was to be a king. And Shantideva was born into this family. His mother was said to be an emanation of Vajrayogini, okay, which is a very high Buddhist, enlightened woman, Buddha, all right? And according to tradition, his mother was an emanation of Vajrayogini. At the age of 6, he met a tantric teacher, a teacher of secret Buddhism. And he taught him the practice of Manjushri, which is the Buddha of wisdom. It's the form in which the Buddha takes that reflects the Buddha's knowledge. And he was given by this teacher a practice to reach Manjushri. It's called a sadhana. And the word reach is important. Reach means meet, but also become. And that's the meaning of sadhana. So the point was that he was taught by a teacher of the secret teachings, a practice by which he could first meet Manjushri and then become Manjushri. And this teacher gave him this practice at the age of 6. He worked on it really hard, and after a while he was able to meet Manjushri directly and take teachings from Manjushri. So if someone in this room could meet Manjushri, the nature of it would be that the other people in this room might not even be able to see Manjushri. You know, like some people would be, if you had practiced that practice sincerely, you could meet and talk to Manjushri himself, and you would be able to have direct communication with that being. And then maybe other people in the room wouldn't know what you were doing. They'd say you're a little crazy, maybe. Okay, probably. Anyway, he could meet Manjushri, and he had teachings from Manjushri. At a certain age, his father passed away, the king passed away, and the people in the kingdom, this is the nature of a very person with very good karma, like you don't have to go through an election. Everybody in the kingdom comes and says, oh, please be king, you know. And it was the nature of his karma that the entire population begged him to be king. This is also true of world emperors in the Abhidharma, in the third chapter. They describe a certain kind of karma where not only do you become king of the world, but people are begging you to be king of the world, unanimously. So he had this karma. People begged him to be king. And he didn't have any particular interest in being king because he had been practicing bodhisattva way of life for a long time. And he didn't want to do it. But then he realized that if he refused, everyone would be upset. And bodhisattvas don't like people to get upset. So he said, okay, I'll be king, you know. The day before the coronation, he had a dream. And in the dream, Manjushri, who's this incredibly, you know, beautiful bodhisattva, was sitting on the throne, his father's throne. And you know, Shantideva, Master Shiva, he comes into, he wasn't called Shantideva at that time, he was called Shiva Gocha? No. Which we're not quite sure about the Sanskrit. But anyway, that was his monk's name. So, before he became monk. So, he came in, and in the dream, he's looking at the throne and thinking, well, I have to get up on this throne. But Manjushri's already there. And then Manjushri says, you can't get on this throne. Your teacher's sitting on this throne. You know, it's very improper in Buddhism to sit where your teacher's sitting. So, Manjushri said, you know, you can't get on this throne because I'm sitting on this throne. So, when he woke up, he took it as a sign that he should not become a king. And he actually ran away that morning. He ran away from the palace, like he just split. And people were looking for him and he was gone. And he ran out into the forest and he searched for a monastery. And he found, he ended up at a great monastery called Nalandra in northeast India. And this is an extremely famous monastery of ancient India. He began studying there. He took the vows to leave the home life, and he started to study. As soon as he started to study, he grasped everything immediately because of his past lives, and he became a great scholar very quickly. There were two kinds of... But he never let on that he was a great scholar and a great master of Buddhism. He would just lead a very quiet life. And in fact, he decided that he wouldn't reveal himself to anybody. And even though he had already reached a very high bodhisattva levels and seen amazing things, he didn't want to show anybody. So he pretended to be a big goof-off. And he basically just ate and slept and went to the bathroom. And so he became known by the name... I like this name. It seems to fit many of us. There were two kinds of monks living in Nalandra at the time. Like half the monks in Nalandra at that time. And Nalandra was big. It was like 1,000 monks. About half of them could read your mind, could read people's minds. And those that could read minds, they knew he wasn't Busuku. But those who couldn't read minds, as far as they could see, this guy was sitting around, eating a lot, sleeping a lot, and pooping a lot. And apparently he didn't have any other concerns or interests, so they called him Dushi Sumbawa. Say Dushi Sumbawa. Dushi Sumbawa. So he got a reputation for being Dushi Sumbawa. Okay, and it's often used in monasteries to describe certain kinds of monks, okay? Who appear to be big goofoffs. So they said, he only cares about three things. Nalandra Monastery at the time had a very high reputation. It was like Harvard or something of Buddhist world at the time. And they were very embarrassed by having a monk who all he did was eat, sleep, and do the other thing. So they decided, they had a big meeting, like a secret meeting, and they decided to get rid of him. And they thought the best way to get rid of him would be embarrass him in such a way that he would leave the monastery himself, and that would save them the trouble and the bad karma of kicking a monk out of a monastery. So they had this big meeting, and they decided, you know, there's certain rituals in the monastic calendar where one of the monks, Sojong is one of them, where one of the monks has to get up and recite from a sutra from memory. We're not allowed to take a piece of paper. So they said, let's let Shantideva be the reciter this time. And he'll blow it, and he'll be embarrassed, and he'll leave the monastery on his own and save us the trouble of kicking him out. So they went to Shantideva and they said, would you like to be the reciter tonight? Or, you know, at the next Sojong or whatever. And he said, hey, I'm just a stupid monk, you know, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I'd be capable of doing that. And then, you know, their plan would fail, but if he said that, so they said, come on, please, you know. And he said, all right, I'll do it. I don't know if I can do it, but I'll try. So they prepared this temple. You can still see the ruins of Nalanda Monastery. I mean, it existed 13 centuries ago. And you can still see that it was huge. And they had this huge meeting hall, maybe 1,000, 2,000 monks, whatever. And they prepared it in advance. They prepared a throne, like 12 feet high or something, like something really high, because you're supposed to recite from a high place. But they made sure that there was no way to get up on the throne. Like, they didn't put any steps up to the throne or any ladder or anything. They just had this big high throne, like up here, where you could never get up to it. And they were going to embarrass him further, you know, like he would spend half an hour trying to climb up on there. So the story is that Master Shantideva came into the assembly, and if you've ever been in a huge assembly of monks, it's very powerful. You know, there's 1,000 monks and all this energy flowing through the temple. And he walks down the main aisle and he goes to the front and he does his prostrations to the throne, which means, you know, I'm only the representative of the Buddha tonight. And then everybody's watching and starting to giggle, you know, and which often happens in monastic gatherings. And he goes up to the throne and he like puts his hand on it like that, and then suddenly he's on it. Suddenly he's up on top of it. And everyone's like, how do you do that? You know? So suddenly, without any effort, he's just up sitting on top of the throne. And then he began to recite the guide to, first he made an announcement. He said, do you want me to do some sutra that you heard before, or could I recite something original? And they said, oh, make a fool out of yourself, you know, recite something we haven't heard before. So he said, okay, I know this one thing called Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and maybe you'll like it. And he began to recite. The guide is in poetry. It's very beautiful poetry in Sanskrit, and it's pretty good in Tibetan. And he began to recite. He started from, the book has 9 or 10 chapters. He recited through the first 8 chapters. He got into the 9th chapter. And they were just, everyone was totally amazed. You know, it was like incredibly beautiful. The meaning and the poetry both were extraordinary. And they were just entranced. You know, they're sitting there watching him. And the 9th chapter deals with emptiness. So he started to get into the 9th chapter, and it got harder and harder. You know, people still write commentaries on the 9th chapter, just by itself. And they're trying to catch it, they're trying to understand what he's saying, and he's slowing down and he's reciting very carefully, and he's trying to communicate to them the meaning of it, and he's reciting and reciting, and then suddenly about a third of the way through the chapter, he begins to rise off the throne, you know, into the air. So he's like rising off the throne into the air. And the monks are just sitting there like that, you know, staring at him and trying to understand what he's saying about emptiness. And he keeps rising and rising and rising. And then suddenly, the history book says, you know, as if his mind and space itself were competing for space, you know, like his mind was more vast than space. And it couldn't fit him anymore. And he started to rise up out of sight. And people were trying to hear, and then a few people, you could still hear him, but you couldn't see him anymore. And then there were a few people that could read people's minds and hear. There's a thing called Nawe Munche, which means the ability to hear something that's going on 100 miles away. And like 5 or 6 monks had that, and they were like straining to hear him, and he was out of sight, and he was still reciting, and they could hear him. And then suddenly he's just gone. Suddenly it's quiet, and there's 1,000 monks sitting there, you know, and he's gone, you know. And they had all these meetings afterwards, and they're trying to piece what he said together. Like a good, those monks at Nalanda were extraordinary, and a lot of them had total recall. So they sat down, and they began to compare what they remembered, and they began to write out the Bodhicharavatara from memory. And the people who had heard him, you know, the people who had clairvoyance were saying, oh, wait, there's one more line, you know, you guys didn't hear it. He said this, and somebody else said, no, there was 4 more lines, you know. And then somebody else said, no, there was a whole other chapter that you guys didn't hear, you know. So there began to be this big fight about whether there was 9 chapters or 10 chapters. And there was this group in the monastery, it formed into factions, you know, as usual. And there was one group that said, there's 9 chapters, and some group said, no, you didn't hear the last chapter, there's 10 chapters. And there was a big fight about it. Sometime later, they found out that Chandideva had landed somewhere in South India, you know, hundreds of miles away. And they sent out search parties to try to find him and ask him to come back. And they got to South India and they found him at a stupa called Pelyunchen. And he was just sitting there meditating. And they said, hey, we're really sorry, you know, for calling you Mr. Three Thoughts and everything. And could you kind of explain more about this book? And there's a chapter in this book where he mentions 2 other books that he wrote. He wrote what's called Shikshya Samuchaya, which is a collection of trainings. And he wrote a commentary on the sutras called Sutra Samuchaya. And they said, could you, you know, we're really sorry, and could you teach us those other 2 books too? And he said, well, first of all, I'm not coming back to Nalanda. I can't come back. But I will teach you again the Bodhicharavatara and give you more instruction, and I'll teach you the collection of trainings, which he did on the spot. He taught 2 monks and they went back and began teaching it, and we still have those 2 of those books in the Tengyur, in the canon that he taught. And he said, if you want the written copy, and if you want to know how many chapters there are for sure, I left a copy in the rafters of my room written in tiny letters on these little pieces of paper. And they went back to his room and they found stashed away 2 of the books that we still study in the monastery. Then he went through a period of his life where he would be meditating and he would think to himself, I wonder what would be the best thing that I could do to help other people right now. And then he would see some situation where people were hungry or where people were having some kind of a war or conflict. And then he would go and get involved with it. So I think he was really like one of the first socially involved Buddhist masters. You know, he's famous for having gone to one area of India where there was a famine. He did some miracles to feed the people there, and then he taught the people there Buddhism. There was another incident where there was like a conflict and a war, and he got involved and he solved it. He stopped it, and he solved that. That's in his biography. And then there was a very famous incident where there was a king who was being endangered by some ruffians, and you'll read about it. You can just read the biography. And then he did some extraordinary things. He was, in the last part of his life, in his biography, he would confront people who were teaching strange things. You know, like people would teach some strange thing like, if you commit suicide, you can reach nirvana. Or emptiness means you can do whatever you want. Everything's empty, so you don't have to be a good person anymore. And there were people teaching things like that. So he would actually go to that person. He would challenge that person to a public debate or a public argument. And then they would have public contests of reasoning. And actually, in front of thousands of people, then they would decide these questions. And there's one famous incident where the person was losing, the other person was losing, and but they knew magic, so they started to do magic in the sky, and it turned into a magic contest, you know, and like that. And then finally, Master Shantideva was victorious. And there were many stories of him disguising himself as a beggar or as a know-nothing or as just a stupid old guy, and then going to some place, and then eventually everyone realizes who he really is. So the purpose of studying his life is, I think, twofold. One is that the process that you're going to learn, the Bodhisattva's way of life, is first of all the tradition from the man who started it, from the man who wrote the book, is that it's for you yourself. It's for you to practice privately. You know, nobody has to know that you're a Bodhisattva. You know, nobody knew that he was a Bodhisattva. From all appearances, he was a plain old guy. He was an expert at just appearing like a plain old guy. The point is that you have to become a Buddha yourself. You have to perfect this path yourself. And the arena, or the place where you're going to do it, is your office, or your house, or your where you hang out, or the coffee shop where you hang out, or something like that. In other words, this book is designed that you practice it in your life as it exists now. Okay? There's no change required in your circumstances. Okay? The perfecting the six perfections, which is the subject of the book, occurs where? I mean, it's wherever. Okay? It's mental. You can do it wherever you are. That's the whole point. That's the beauty of the Bodhisattva's way of life. It's private. It's interior. It's even secret. I mean, you are doing it inside yourself. It will become apparent to people that you're a Bodhisattva eventually, but not necessarily. And they could mistake you for years. You could look like a normal person. And the point is that it's interior. What's the change that's going to go on is inside. And the Bodhisattva's way of life is a way of life that you live inside. And that's the first lesson, I think, that you learn from Shantideva's way of life. I'm going to outline just very briefly. We're running behind, which is very unusual. And there's one more thing on your homework that I'm going to put. Okay, then we can stop. I wanted you to know the basic structure of the book, you know, which is the structure of your life from now on, if you choose to try it. Okay, and as I said, you have a choice. You know, you can either go out and just die, or you can try it. Okay, and I think if you try it, you'll find that it works. It's very amazing, and you're very fortunate to be introduced to this book. Okay, so I'm going to outline the 10 chapters for you. Say, Changchu. Changchu. Oh, it's getting late, but you got to make noise. Changchu. Ki. Semki. Panyin. Okay. The first chapter, the function of the first chapter is a couple of things. It's to get you excited about the Bodhisattva's mind state, which is called Bodhicitta. Okay, Bodhicitta is the name for the way a Bodhisattva thinks. And you can't do any Bodhisattva's work until you think like a Bodhisattva. Okay? And I like to call it a warrior, you know, and we'll talk about it more. But basically, Bodhisattva means a warrior, a spiritual warrior. And, you know, when I say warrior, you think like, hey, I can't be a warrior. I'm just a plain old office worker, you know. But a spiritual warrior you can be. And the warfare is done at your office. And the enemy is your mind, parts of your mind. And the warfare will go on in your mind. And if you win, you will be much greater warrior than all these guys who just go around cutting up flesh, you know. It's much more difficult to control your mind than to kill other people in a battle. Much more difficult. 1,000 times more difficult to fight with your own mind than to fight with some physical enemy. Okay. So you're going to be a warrior like that. The battlefield will be your office, or your home, or your family, especially that guy. Okay? And you got to get into the state of mind. The mind is called bodhicitta. Another name for it is the wish for enlightenment. Okay? That's the first chapter. Those of you who know Lam Rim, this also covers the first two stages of Lam Rim, which is the steps for beginning people and the steps for intermediate people, okay, are all contained in the first chapter. Say Dikpa, Shakpa. Dikpa, Shakpa. Dikpa comes from a word that means threaten. Dikpa is a verb that means threaten. And this noun has come to mean bad deeds, something wrong that you did or you said or you thought. Shakpa is the word that's used for splitting wood. And what it means is to bare your soul, to open up and bare your soul. And what it means is, if you choose, as of tonight, to attempt the way of a bodhisattva, which is really the only way to get out of suffering, which is the only way to get out of death, you have to prepare your heart. You have to clean your heart. And there's a certain process by which you do that. Okay? And you do it by yourself. You don't go to some little room and there's a guy behind a curtain and something like that. It's some kind of inner purification that you do that sets up your mind to become a bodhisattva. And that's the subject of the second chapter. Okay? It's some kind of inner purification you do of all the negative things that you've done in your life to cancel them or to counteract their energy. And it sets up your mind, it prepares your mind to become a bodhisattva, to get into the bodhisattva's way of mind. When a bodhisattva walks through Manhattan, which bodhisattvas do, they don't see anything like what you see if you're not a bodhisattva. And I don't know if you're a bodhisattva, okay? We don't know, you know, who's a bodhisattva. But their experience of life is totally different. And if you learn it, or if you even learn a little bit of it, aside from overcoming death and all those horrible cosmic things, it's a lot more fun. It's just a great way to be alive. It's a lot of fun to go through your day like that. It's extraordinary. Your life becomes very, very happy and very powerful and very sweet and amazing. Things you can't dream of, things you literally can't imagine right now will start to happen to you. But you have to purify first. To get into that state of mind, you have to purify. That's the second chapter. Okay. Third chapter. Say, Changchubgi. Sem. Sungwa. Changchubgi. Sem. Sungwa. Okay. Acquiring has two meanings here. One is, you know, developing the state of mind of a bodhisattva. Getting the state of mind of a bodhisattva, which comes before you start acting like a bodhisattva. Okay. Secondly, it refers to a ceremony by which you commit yourself to think like a bodhisattva. Okay. There's traditionally, in the old days, there were two ceremonies. One ceremony by which you swear that for the rest of your life you will think like a bodhisattva. And then another ceremony where you swear that you will keep certain bodhisattva vows. Nowadays they have been joined into one ceremony, but the old way, which is still considered the best by people like Jetsun Kapa, is that there should be two ceremonies. And it's just where you figure out what it is to think like a bodhisattva, and then you decide to commit yourself to it. And I think it'd be very cool if at the end of this course, if you get into the state of mind of a bodhisattva, or if you decide it's something nice, that we could do it here. We could have that ceremony, and we could, you know, really fix up this place, you know, like a Buddha paradise, and do it at the end, you know, just make a commitment to think like a bodhisattva, which is a very unusual way of thinking and very beautiful. And if you even just do a little bit of it, your life will be incredible. A very sweet life after that. So we'll try to do that maybe, I think. That's what that means. And specifically, Chapter 3 is talking not only about how to get it, but how to collect good energy. You see, what was Chapter 2? It's purifying negative energy. And then Chapter 3 is all of these tricks for collecting good energy. If you're going to be a bodhisattva, or if you're going to start acting like a bodhisattva, you have to clean your mind, and then you have to collect all this good energy in advance. And there's all these special spiritual practices, meditations, and special practices you can do to start, you know, it's like those ever-ready batteries you stick into the wall and they charge them by the next morning. So purification is like getting it down to zero. And then plugging into the wall is Chapter 3, is where you learn all these special meditations where you can you draw on spiritual energy in the whole universe. You know, you're drawing on that energy and you're getting it into yourself. And then you're ready to be a bodhisattva. Then you're ready to start acting like a bodhisattva. Okay? So chapter 3 is again like a preparation. We're not going to do the whole 10 chapters in the first course. We're going to spread it out over 3 courses in the course of the whole year. Okay? So probably that's about all we'll do in the first course, and that's plenty. Okay? If you really taught the Bodhicharyavatara well, which Ken Rinpoche did, it took about 12 years. Say Bhagya Temba. Bhagya Temba. Bhagya is a hard thing to translate. It's related to Tibetan words for bride. Okay? A new wed bride. And it refers to when in Asia, when the woman goes to stay with the husband's family and she's like, you know, has to do everything just right, or the mother-in-law screams, right? And that's Bhagya. So Bhagya means to do something with great care, carefulness. And this carefulness refers to once you learn how to think like a bodhisattva, and once you start to get into acting like a bodhisattva, which is totally different than anything you ever did before. It's a whole new skill. And no one knows you're doing it. It's all inside. But when you start and you start to grow it, you have to take really good care of it. Because it's very fragile at that point. And Bhagya means some kind of care that you take with your baby bodhisattva mind. That you're like being very careful to protect it and make sure it doesn't get ruined. And that's Bhagya. That whole chapter is devoted to that. We're using a text that's very old and it has a lot of corruptions in it. And we're trying to fix it as we go, but it's very corrupt. It's a very old manuscript and it has many mistakes in it. So we're trying to fix it as we go. Say, Shishin Suwa. Shishin Suwa. Shishin is a state of mind especially useful in meditation, which I like to call it the alarm button or something like that. It's a state of mind, especially when you're meditating, that turns on the alarm. When your mind wanders, like you're supposed to be meditating on compassion or something, and you start to think about what you're going to have for breakfast, Shishin is the state of mind that says, whoa, you know, wait a minute. You're supposed to be thinking about compassion, you know, and you're thinking about pancakes, which I do all the time, you know. And Shishin is the state of mind that catches yourself. So Shishin, we've called it awareness. It's some kind of it's a little corner of your mind that, especially during meditation, that rings the alarm when the mind is wandering. And it can also apply to your whole bodhisattva attitude. This rings the alarm when you're about to scream at somebody at work. Hey, wait a minute, you're a bodhisattva, you know. You're starting to get jealous of somebody at work, you know. Hey, wait a minute, didn't you just commit yourself last week to helping all sentient beings achieve all their wishes? And you're unhappy that somebody got something, you know? And Shishin goes off. So that's awareness. There's another state of mind called Temba. Say Temba. Temba. Which is also the subject of this chapter. It's an equal subject of this chapter, but it's not in the name of the chapter. And that's why I put that little and recollection. Demba. Demba we call recollection, and that's a state of mind that keeps you on your subject. Okay? It's two different states of mind in meditation. One of them says, hey, wait a minute, you're wandering. That's Shishin. That's awareness. There's another state of mind that says, oh, let's stick to the subject. Let's stay on the subject. And that's Demba. That's recollection. And that's the difference between those two. So the fourth chapter is treating these two kinds of awareness. And they not only apply to meditation, but they apply throughout the day to your bodhisattva behavior. Okay. This has been translated. It's a very hard word to translate. Say sopa. Sopa. This is the word they mispronounce, the poor lamas in the world whose name is Supa. They say Zopa, okay, or something like that. It's Supa. And it's very hard to translate in English. You can say forbearance. You can say patience. To me, patience means, you know, being able to wait for a bus, which I do often, or being able to wait. But Supa is a much more specific thing. It's not getting angry. It's the art of not getting angry when the time comes. When someone yells at you, or when something goes wrong in your life, or when there's a traffic jam. It does not have to be a sentient being. It can be a situation. It can be your own life. It's the art of not getting upset or angry when things aren't going well. Okay? And there's a whole chapter devoted to that. Say, Tsundu Temba. Tsundu Temba. Tsundu means, it's a tough word to translate also. It's defined as Tsunkan Gela Tro'o in this chapter, opening lines. Tsundu is defined as having a good time doing good things. Okay? It's to enjoy doing good things. It's to get off on or to get high off of being good. You know, working hard to do good things. Rinpoche often said it's not tsundu to go out and work on your car for 6 hours. Okay? That's effort, but it's not tsundu. Tsundu means it's time to do some mighty good deed and you're excited and you have enthusiasm for it. Okay? That's tsundu. And that's the subject of that whole chapter. Say, samten? Temba. Samten? Temba. By the way, temba throughout here means chapter. Okay? Samten means meditation, the ability to meditate deeply. Especially as a platform from which to see emptiness directly. Okay? Especially for that purpose. Although not only for that purpose. Say, shirab ki liu. Shirab ki liu. Shirab means wisdom. Many kinds of wisdom. The ultimate one is how to see emptiness directly. Okay? And this is the chapter. Suddenly, they have changed the Tibetan word for chapter. Okay? Around the 9th or 10th chapter. The last chapter, say, Ngoe Liu. Ngoe Liu. Ngoe means the act of dedication. And we're going to do one after class in about 1 minute. And it's where you, in this particular case, you take some good thing that you've done, like coming to this class, and you try to visualize it as an epicenter, like a place where you throw a stone in a pond, and you try to see the effects or the, what do you call that? Like ripples or repercussions of what we did tonight spreading out into the universe. Like this looks like just a group of people who got together on a night in New York City. It's conceivable that from the activity we do tonight, that millions of people are affected in the future. You know, it's conceivable that among this group, there's a person or people who will either themselves or through other people turn millions of people on to ideas which could stop them from dying or lead them to some kind of existence in a paradise or something. You know, it's possible from this book to do that. And it's possible that somewhere in this room there's the seed for that. You know, someone in this room. Or someone's going to say something to someone who comes. And they get it. And they do it. And then they teach other people to do it. And that's the whole idea. The idea is that you come here, and I'm not talking about you teach people Tibetan language or you teach people 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or something like that. You learn how to stop your own death. You learn how to change this kind of body into some kind of angel's body. And you learn how to reach some kind of paradise. Personally. And then you pass it on to other people. And it's quite conceivable, it's even probable, that through meetings like this, somebody does it. Or someone's in the process of doing it, or someone has already done it. And that through the process of what we're doing, that instructions, those instructions are passed on to other people. And they do it. And they actually pull it off. And so, dedication means you see this event tonight like a stone being thrown in a pond. And you imagine these ripples could pass on that knowledge that's been passed to us. I mean, that's the whole idea. Okay? And that's why it's important for you to get it straight. Okay? You have to get it straight. You know, you can see, I have people say, he said I get kicked out after 2 classes. Now, which 2 am I going to miss, you know? Did it occur to you? No. that's not the point, you know. You are entrusted tonight with a very holy, sacred, life-saving thing, and you have to treasure it and take good care of it. That's the whole idea of the notebook. Take good care of your notebook. Treat it like the last book of instructions on how to cure AIDS or something, which is, it's more important than that. And you're entrusted with that. So now you have some kind of responsibility. You have to do it yourself, and then you have to spread it to other people. That's the idea. So that's the chapter on dedication. Last thing, last question. Did Shantideva, for those of you who've had some Buddhist classes, get all the Master Shantideva, did he get all the perfections in his book, or did he miss a few? What, we're talking the six perfections. Let's write them down for people who... These are the six high points in a bodhisattva's career. Okay? Six things bodhisattvas are all supposed to do. So that we have a chapter called Suppe. Do we?
Suppe Dhamma?
What's
that?
Six.
Huh?
Six?
Okay.
So we talked about it's covered in chapter 6, right? So we got one out of 6. He's not doing too bad. Any other one?
Huh?
Wisdom is easy, yeah. He got wisdom. What's happening? He covered wisdom in chapter 1. He got wisdom. But you can also
talk about
it. In what chapter?
Joyous effort.
Do you miss anything? Joyous effort. You got... In what chapter?
Seven.
Seven. He's missing two. It's not too bad, it's for a previous amount. Okay, this is true. Okay, the chapter is called Guardian Awareness, which is what chapter?
Five.
What's that? Chapter five of it? Okay. It's particularly to be applied in keeping an ethical way of life. But that chapter relates to the second perspective, which is, I'm going to put it living an ethical way of life. It's often translated as morality. I don't know about you, but I always think of Billy Graham. Ethical way of life, I think, is built that way. Leading a good life. A good life. Living by ethical life. So he covered that in chapter 5. But he's missing. What's the best thing that you people do to give to people in the future? I mean, specifically, Muslims. I mean, it's exactly what you're learning. Really, seriously, exactly what you're learning. If what we said is, I don't say it is, if what we said is true, and if by learning this book and putting it into your life, you can yourself reach the paradox in this life, and get out of that way of life that is being committed in Manhattan like that, apparently, you know, of people just running until they drop dead, literally, you know. If you could put an end to that with other people, you personally could learn how to do it. If you could really learn how to do it and pass it on to someone else, there'd be no greater good. There's no greater good than that. People have enough bagels and parkers and clothes. We got clothes in New York. But to give that to somebody would be the greatest gift. So that's dedication. You know, the act of dedication is going to teach people. So that's good. The next chapter. Okay, we'll meditate just for, we'll just do 1 minute silence, okay? Think about the ripple effect, you know. Imagine the possibility. I always think of, I mean, I'm not getting messianic, okay? But I think of Jesus, you know, with 12 people in some little town somewhere and affecting millions of people. And it will happen. it could happen. So think of this, think of a ripple effect. Think of what could happen from this. If it's true that you can really reach those things in this life before your body dies, then it's extraordinary. Extraordinary things to start here. And imagine, dedicate that, dedicate what we did tonight. Try to imagine that it could trigger something. Do that for like 1 minute, and then we'll do a short period, and I'll find out if you want to go so late next time. Right.
Five.
Chapter 5 of it? It's particularly to be applied in keeping an ethical way of life. But that chapter relates to the second perspective, which is, I'm going to put it living in ethical way of life. It's often translated as morality. I don't know about you, but I always think of Billy Graham. Ethical way of life, I think, is all about it. Leading a good life. A good life. Living by it. So he covered that in chapter 5. But he's missing it. What's the best thing that you people here could give to people in the future? I mean, specifically, what's that? I mean, exactly what you're learning. Really, seriously, exactly what you're learning. If what we said is, I don't say it is, if what we said is true, and if by learning this book and putting it into your life, you can yourself reach a paradox in this life, and get out of that way of life that is being committed in Manhattan right now, apparently, of people just running until they drop dead, literally. You know, if you could put an end to that with other people, you personally could learn how to do it. You could really learn how to do it and pass it on to someone else. There'd be no greater gift. There's no greater gift than that. People have enough bagels and apartments, clothes. We got clothes in New York. But to give that to someone would be the greatest gift. So that's dedication. The act of dedication is to learn to teach people. So, that did it. And that's chapter 6. Okay, we'll meditate just for, we'll just do 1 minute, finally, okay? Think about the ripple effect, imagine the possibility. I always think of, I'm not getting messy on it, okay? But I think of Jesus, with 12 people in some little town somewhere and affecting millions of people. And it will happen. It could happen. So think of this, think of a ripple effect. Think of what could happen from this. If it's true that you can really reach those things in this life before your body dies, then it's extraordinary. Extraordinary things to start. And imagine, dedicate that, dedicate what we did tonight. Try to imagine that it could trigger something. Do that for like 1 minute, and then we'll do a short period, and I'll find out if you want to go so late next time.